All right, this is tape four, side A. What role has serendipity played in your research, if at all?
Everything is. When you start with mutations, everything is serendipitous, in a sense. Chance and necessity. I'm not sure. In a couple of projects, we've certainly had the opposite of serendipity. whatever that is. What was the opposite to the Isle of Serendip? Some place where there was a lot of shipwrecks, I guess.
Right.
Maybe the Bermuda Triangle. We've had Bermuda Triangularity in a couple of projects. One where we thought we had a serendipity going for us, and we thought when cloning the Nambe gene, we thought we had the obvious breakpoint. And it turned out to have nothing at all with the gene, but basically cost me a year of the best technician that I had in the lab. His time was totally wasted working on that.
Mm-hmm.
We've never had a fast way to clone a gene in Drosophila is to make a P element transposon that can both mutate the gene and tag it for quick cloning. We've never been able to make it, despite trying, we've never been able to get a P element mutation in any one of our genes. When certainly not the ones that we were originally going for. So some of the time I felt like we were going uphill against serendipity. Some of the other things, I think it was serendipitous that the first mutations that we found in the X chromosome screen were in fact the right ones, that the ones we decided to focus on were the ones which eventually led to the ciliogenesis project, even though they weren't transduction. They had the right phenotype. They were sensory defective.
Right.
I think the biggest role serendipity has played, though, and where I've been luckiest, has been in the people that I've got in the lab. The Yandu Chung, the postdoc who's working on the Nambe project and now working on ion channels, the hearing ion channels, applied to Charles's lab from Korea. Charles didn't want to take the risk of hiring somebody without meeting and seeing them first. By that stage, I was certainly willing to take any risk to get a postdoc, and he's been fantastic. That I think has worked out very well. Dan Eberl, who spent a year in the lab helping me work out how to record fly hearing, doing the electrophysiology for auditory recordings, that worked out great. James Baker, did the UNC project, he came with his wife she went into another lab at Stony Brook, and I think James is fantastic. He's worked out great. So from my point of view, I've been luckiest in the people that I've been able to attract to the lab.
Right.
And any anything involving personal decisions always seems like there's that element of uncertainty, and so serendipity enters there.
Right.
I find it serendipitous that I'm doing science and that I get to do this job.
What are some of the long and short-term applications of your work?
Short-term. There's the chance still, I think, that we may identify some of the genes that are involved in mutations to human deafness. Some of the things have turned that we thought were points of similarity between some extremely intriguing points of similarity between fly bristles and human ears. They both have this very strange physiological mechanism where in which the extracellular space from which the sensory cells draw the ion current that makes the receptor potential, that space is physiologically very peculiar in both systems, and peculiar in the same way in each system. It's high in potassium. Usually extracellular solutions are high in sodium and low in potassium. So an inward receptor current is usually a sodium current. Here in both fly bristles and in the human inner ear, it's a potassium inward current. That, however, the more we know about it, it seems to be a case of convergence, similarity because of evolutionary descent, but a similarity because of selection.
Right.
That basically both flies and humans have happened on the same way to solve some physiological problem, even though we're not sure of why they have why, quote, they've chosen, unquote, to do so. But the both sorts of sensory cells are ciliated. It's clear that there's a lot of developmental similarities between hair cells and bristles. So we think maybe some of the channels we're coming on now, the vertebrate homologs of those channels are expressed in hair cells.
Mm-hmm.
And that was shown before we found they had an effect on fly hearing. They've not previously been suspected to be involved directly in transduction, but we think they might be. Other molecules, anything involved with ciliogenesis, like I said, things like vertebrate sensory cells, human sensory cells, like photoreceptors, olfactory receptors, are also ciliated. We may be turning up molecules that have to do with either retinal development or retinal degeneration.
Mm-hmm.
And by turning up molecules involved in the general process. I think long-term has to do with, again, I put my money on the ciliogenesis project for long-term payoff because they get to this very fundamental cell biological process of cell division, which is the basis of cancer. Polycystic kidney disease is a cell proliferation defect. It's a dominant inheritance pattern, but a loss of function mutation, which means that if you inherit one knocked out allele, even a mutation in the other allele, in even a single cell, can lead to the formation of a cyst,
mm-hmm.
or which is equivalent to saying a tumor in this case, because that single cell will then, once it's lost both copies of the relevant gene, will then go and proliferate. We don't know what the relevant molecules, why knocking out a polycystin gene in the cell leads it to proliferate. But because of the connection between basal bodies and centrioles, my guess is that it's something to do with the involvement of centrioles in cell division, how they can be deprogrammed from their role as a basal body back into a cell division promoting centriole.
Right.
So that currently that's potentially the biggest payoff from the work that we're doing. But you know, I've got to say, my motivation isn't driven by payoffs or by applications,
mm-hmm.
even though that's where I know that's where we get our money. But it's always driven by exploration, both exploration back into the deep history of cells and into those things we don't know about.
Right.
The most exciting bit of research that I did in the lab myself recently, or probably the only bit of research I did in the lab recently, had to do with polycystins, but finding a role in Drosophila for them. We were asking flies have polycystins, they don't have kidneys, they have an equivalent of kidneys, but the polycystins don't seem to be expressed there and don't seem to have a role there. What do they do in Drosophila? And it turns out they're expressed in sperm, only in males, and they seem to be involved in sperm function, not in development, but a normal female fly cannot store sperm from a male that has its polycystins mutated.
Hmm.
Are one of them. That's the mutation. This is a collaboration. The mutation was made by Terry Wadnick in working at Johns Hopkins with Craig Montell. So we were lucky enough to be provided with the mutant, but I got to find out the phenotype. That ranks up there with the discoveries that I've made. That was really a lot of fun biology I was able to do this summer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a case of it's that sort of discovery. That I think we don't know what it means now. I think Terry in particular is having some difficulty convincing the people in her medical department that fly sperm have any value in terms of applications to medical problems now. But I still think that's worth things like that are worth pursuing.
Right. Okay, you have changed gears a little bit. I move away from your research, current research, and talk a little bit about your duties as a principal investigator. What do you spend the bulk of your time doing as a PI now?
Right now, I'm not sure I spend the bulk of my time doing anything. It seems to be so subdivided and so interrupted. I try to spend it. I certainly work better when I can spend the bulk of my time doing one thing, but right now, my main teaching semester is the spring, not the fall, so right now I'm not doing a lot of teaching, but it's time to organize the graduate genetics course, which I direct, so I've got to assemble and recruit and schedule all the faculty who team teach that course. It's I'll be right now the bulk of the time, though, this semester is doing what I should be doing and actually like doing, which is trying to keep up with all the projects that are going on in the lab, interpret the results, and get them into publishable form.
Right.
Which has been our main failing lately, or my main failing as a PI, is not getting enough papers out fast enough. I don't have the excuse any longer that we really don't know what's going on yet, which we used to have in the positional days when we were doing positional cloning only, where you cannot publish a story really until you found the gene, and you can't really predict how long it's going to take you to find the gene. Much to my chairman's dismay, he would say, "Well, can't you give me a time estimate?" And I'd say, honestly, I really couldn't, because there are so many contingencies going into that sort of project. But now we've got some of our genes cloned. We know what's going on. That makes things like collaborations a whole lot easier. And a lot more of my time now, just in the last 6 months even, is taken up with communicating with collaborators. All of a sudden, we've got about 5 collaborative projects going on, whereas before we had none.
Right.
And the difference is in, once you know what molecule you're working on, once you know what system you're working on, it makes that a lot, making connections to other labs a lot easier.
Okay. Do you still do bench work?
Yes, but not as a more... In the summer, as I mentioned, I was able to. Probably that was the first time I was able to do some sustained bench work. I'd say for about half the year, yes, I can manage to do some fly work. Then more often than not, those crossing schemes get abandoned halfway through because something comes up and I just don't get back to the flies in time.
Right.
It's been a long time since I did in molecular work. Electrophysiology, I still do. I'm the person in the lab who does probably most of the electrophysiology. But our electrophysiology is pretty cheap and straightforward. I mean, a major step in the project was developing the electrophysiological assays, which showed that our mutants were in fact sensory defects. Each of the techniques had been done before, but actually using them for this purpose, that was a big advance. But our real electrophysiologists probably wouldn't consider what we do with much respect at all, but it's effective, it's fast, it's cheap again, and it's geneticist electrophysiology, it's repeatable. So you can do it perhaps not as a first order screen where you're doing thousands, but you could think of screening up to 100 lines electrophysiologically by this method, by these methods.
Okay, another duty you've already mentioned, teaching. I know you do some. I spoke with Nancy Hollingsworth today, and of course, both of you, I didn't know this,
right.
Do a genetics
course.
We
teach the genetics course, the undergrad
course. So is it my understanding then that you teach one semester of the year then?
No, we each teach half of that course.
Okay.
So she teaches the first half of the semester, I teach the second half. That's the major undergraduate teaching commitment. I'd say the various graduate courses and things in which I give a couple of lectures probably amount to would be the equivalent of the other half of the semester. So it's a pretty light teaching load, just to one large course equivalent. Things do tend to slow down. Nothing much else tends to happen while that, particularly that large undergrad course, is being taught. Because there's all that many contact hours, but there just seems to be enough stuff to do when you're dealing with 400 students. it takes up time.
It does.
Getting all of my lectures into a PowerPoint presentation format was something I invested a lot of time in last semester, and hopefully that'll pay off in terms of making it easier to review and easier to update lectures and easier to provide materials for the students as well.
On average, how often do you travel during a year?
I would guess about on average, 1.5 meetings a year. That is travel to one meeting every year and a second meeting about every other year. And maybe looks these days I'm getting maybe about 2 invited lectures a year. Those mostly in the New York area. So.
Right. And how do you feel about job-related travel? I mean, is it something that you want to do more of, or is that something that you sort of
it's something that wouldn't want to do too much more of it than I'm doing now, mainly for family reasons. But I definitely notice the difference in my relationship with my kids when I've been able to spend a full weekend with them versus not. Or so I don't want to be away from home too much.
Right.
Karen, my wife, started working. She's been working full time for a year now, and that's put an extra constraint on the amount of time we both can spend. Mm-hmm. So, but that said, though, job-related travel is definitely one of the perks of being a scientist. I think it's the idea of having this transnational community of science is something that I value a lot. The trip that I went to most recently to, where I managed to string together a European Drosophila meeting and a meeting on centrosomes and centrioles in Dijon, Heidelberg, and then visit collaborators in Lyon. That was a great trip, and particularly the centrosomes meeting was enormously valuable. We've got at least two collaborations coming directly as a result of that meeting. Typically, I'll go to the annual Drosophila meeting every other year.
Right.
And we went to the I've started going to the cell biological meeting, the cell ASCB meeting, last year. We'll probably do that every other year as well. It's strange that cell biology is so much, just as an undergrad, I never learned any neurobiology and had to learn that. I never learned any cell biology in graduate school. That was the gap there. And that's, of course, now we're doing the cell biology of neurons. It's been important to remedy those gaps in my education by learning from real cell biology and real neurobiology labs.
Mm-hmm. Another duty you have is administrative responsibilities. And by those, I mean things like search committees, thesis committees. Were your responsibilities there as well?
Quite a number of thesis committees. Let's see, have I been? Yes, I was on one faculty search committee for the neurobiology department. Right now there's a strategic research planning committee for the medical school. Graduate school admissions committees, not on any now, but did put in a fair amount of time on doing graduate school admissions. I'll be on that again for neurobiology next year. Organized the departmental seminar for a couple of years in neurobiology. It all adds up.
Right. All right. What are the sources of your funding?
Major funding comes from the National Institute for Deafness and Communicative Disorders, NIDCD, which funds a lot of the work on transduction and cilia genesis, again, with the idea that gene discovery in flies might get us at some of the candidate genes for deafness in humans. The Pew funding, of course, was enormously valuable as being helped us expand, particularly the research in Nambe, and then lately I've got a small 2-year grant from Polycystic Kidney Disease Foundation, funding the work in polycystins. We're hoping that's going well, so we're hoping to parlay that into an NIH grant.
Right. Okay, and how sort of day-to-day, how concerned are you about your funding? I mean, how much does that sort of press down?
It comes and goes in a 4 or 5 year cycle, depending on...
So when renewals come around.
So when renewals come closer, I'd say the renewal of the NIH grant was fairly touch and go, and we might easily not have got it, but luckily we did. I don't tend to worry about it too much. I underspend my grants. That is, in the past, we haven't got enough work done, so we haven't spent the grants as soon as we should in some view. But it also means that we run a big surplus, so we've got a reasonably large safety margin. Luckily, the people who administer the grants have been reasonably tolerant and allowed me to carry over, so we've done... extensions of grants for a full year.
You did that with the Pew, right?
We did that with the Pew. Right. We also done it with the NIH grant, which allowed us an extra. We got an extra cycle between an extra year or so before renewing that.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, I don't feel overall, yes, it's a measure of that work in the lab could probably proceed a bit faster, and it is now because it feeds on success. Once you have some of the genes identified, that gives you a whole lot more to do and a whole lot new ways of experiments to think about. Positional cloning can be a bottleneck in that way. I justify it to myself that, okay, the research is progressing maybe 1 year and six more slowly than it should, but and I could be in the lab for more hours perhaps than I am, but I'm not sure I'd be as happy or as productive in the long run.
Right.
So I'm grateful of the flexibility that the funding agencies have shown in that way.
Okay, this would probably be my last question. I was going to ask, and I will, but how much has sort of the sources of your funding informed the projects that you've taken on? From what you've already said, though, I take it that the curiosity, you're driven by curiosity first. You go to a project,
right,
and that's there first. Is that more or less the answer to that question, or do you want to elaborate on that a bit more?
I'd say curiosity first, yes, but I do feel an obligation that we're, we've made promises to granting agencies to do, but the promises have largely been we'll discover what there is to discover about the systems in the way that I described it.
Right.
So I don't think we're doing applied research. I do think it's important that we discover whatever the real story is, whether it's, and by the real story, it takes into account that we may be wrong, or the way we described our specific aims may not be according to the way that the cell is constructed. So, and if that's true, we need to know about it.
Okay, we'll leave it there, and we'll pick up again on Thursday.